Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I wanted to welcome you to the Tattered Cover tonight to celebrate the release of the newest book in James Rowland's New York Times bestselling Sigma Force series, The Sixth Extinction. With its pulse-pounding combination of wild action, real history and science, and Rowland's beloved team of soldiers and scientists who unite again to tackle a blight that may destroy mankind. So, without further ado, please welcome Mr. James Rowland.
Welcome to the End of the World Tour. I've been to this Tattered Cover and other Tattered Cover before. How many? So I've seen a lot of familiar faces out there. How many people actually haven't heard me speak before? So that many? Where were you all? I thought I was going to get off easy tonight. Raise your hands again. I'm remembering all of you. I thought I could skip over how the veterinarian became the author talk, but I'll give a brief version of that. How many people have heard me talk before? So you all can put your head down and relax, because you already heard this part of my story. So I thought I'd just introduce myself a little bit to those that have not heard me speak before, and then we'll talk about the books and open up to Q&A, as I mentioned before in previous signings. Don't know why you're here. Hopefully during the Q&A, you will ask me and tell me and illuminate why you're here today. Because I know whenever I go to a book signing, I always have a question in the back of my head. If the author never gets around to answering it, I never read them again. No, not really. But I want to try to leave as much time for Q&A as I can. Again, I probably gave away the lead by telling you that I am a veterinarian. I think that's probably a poorly kept secret at this point, especially if you follow me on Facebook. You know that probably ad nauseum. So I thought I'd share how a veterinarian became an author. I always wanted to be a veterinarian, loved veterinary medicine. I still do some volunteer work with veterinary medicine, never give it up. I always resent when somebody says former veterinarian when they introduce me. I'm not former. I can still neuter a cat in under 30 seconds. Keep that skill honed both for my, in case people realize, hey, he can't really write, go back to veterinary medicine. I'm prepared for that. It's also good for critics, so it's a good skill set to have. But, you know, I got that assignment you always get sometime in your elementary school years. This happened to me when I was in third grade. I got the assignment that all third grade teachers give you. Go home, write an essay, what you want to be when you grow up. And this was a point of a moral dilemma for the third grade version of myself. I actually still remember sitting at my desk, remember sitting with that blank sheet of paper in front of me. It was a moment of panic because I wanted to fill that out as a veterinarian. The only problem was I didn't know how to spell it. I thought I could put policemen, I could put firemen, I could cheat, fill it out, and then go out and play. But I did the one thing that all third graders hate to do. I actually got the dictionary and looked it up. That determined from third grade to be a veterinarian. Now, that story is appropriate because we're going to skip forward now. Like I said, this is a shortened version of my veterinarian turned author. It's not that short even, but we'll get around to it eventually. So jump forward. First day of vet school. Class is seated. Dean walks in, gives an introductory speech to the entering class, ends the speech with these chilling words, which you probably also remember from school. Take out a sheet of paper, you're having your first pop quiz. It's a one-question quiz. If you get it wrong, we're kicking you out of vet school. Write down the word veterinarian. I was ready from third grade for that question. Not all my schoolmates were. But again, that was this side of my brain that loves animals, loves medicine, loves science. This side of my side a little more twisted, a little weirder. I blame this side on my family. We grew up with I grew up with three brothers and three sisters. So let's do the math. That's seven kids. To keep the Polish flag in your window, because we were raised Polish Roman Catholic, you had to have at least six kids. So my mom had a spare just in case something happened. But they were also my early storytelling, my audience for my storytelling. My goal was to terrorize my younger brothers and sisters. If tears were involved, all the better. I call it storytelling. Mom called it lying, tomatoes, tomatoes. When I was here last time, I'm sure I did the ventriloquist story, because I do the ventriloquist story a lot. Everybody heard the ventriloquist story last time? Who heard me talk before? Did I do the ventriloquist story? Don't have to tell it again, really? I could tell you the carry and the... I have other stories. All right. Oh, dear God. This tour is brought to you by Rockstar. All right, let's go back in the past then. I'm 11 or 12 years old. So I shared a bedroom with my brother Chuck at that time. Chuck was a couple years younger than me. One year I begged and pleaded for a ventriloquist doll. You know, I thought this was going to be a future career of mine. I just sensed that I was going to be the child prodigy of the ventriloquism world. I was going to tour the globe, showing my esteem skill at throwing my voice. Begged and pleaded. Finally, my parents caved, and they got me one of those ventriloquist dolls. It was a Charlie McCarthy doll. Everybody familiar with Charlie McCarthy? You know, creepy in and of itself, that doll. A little pinnacle thing. So I got that doll, and it came with a little 45. That's how long ago this was. A 45 that would teach you how to throw your voice. It was Edgar Bergen teaching you how to throw your voice, and I listened diligently on how to do it. And you know, I knew this was going to work, and I'm listening and listening. So I practiced and practiced, and I realized after about 3 minutes, this wasn't going to work for me. Ventriloquism was not a career for me. I'm going to have to go for veterinary medicine instead. But I thought, what am I going to do with this doll? I've been begging and pleading with my parents for a year. I got to do something with this thing. I get some enjoyment out of this thing. So I get this idea. I go to a bookshelf. I was an avid reader growing up, and I went through my books. I get to a copy of Lord of the Rings. Everybody familiar with Lord of the Rings? You flip to the back. There's a bunch of Nordic runes and Elvish script. Got a sheet of paper, copied some of that down, crumpled the piece of paper, burnt the edges with a match, folded it back up, and I stuck it in the pocket of the doll. Later that night, I'm in my bed. Chuck's in his bed. Doll's on the dresser between us. I go, Chuck, there's something sticking out of the pocket of the doll. Can you see what that is? All right, I guess. Gets up, takes it out, unfolds it. Oh, Jim, it's some old piece of paper. It's got some weird writing on it. Really, Chuck? Let me see. You're right, Chuck. This paper does look old. I'd almost say ancient. And Chuck, I think I recognize this writing. You do? Yeah. Let me do some research. Went to my bookshelf, flipped through books, throwing them over my shoulder till I get, of course, to Lord of the Rings. Flip to the back and go, look, Chuck, it's the same writing. It is. Chuck, I think I can translate it. You can? I think so. I mean, who knows? It might be a secret treasure, a lost incantation. Let me work on this. All right, do it. Then, of course, I pretend to translate it. You know, Chuck, the first word's becoming clear. Beware. Well, that's ominous, isn't it, Chuck? Beware, after midnight, I rise and hunt for blood. Jim, do you think that's real? Looks real, doesn't it? But just in case, let's fold that back up and stick it back in the pocket of the doll. We will never speak of it aloud. We cannot let it know that we have this knowledge. And just as extra precaution, let's make sure before we go to bed every night that thing's locked up. They just reinforced it. Chuck, is the doll in the closet? Yeah, I think so. Make sure. Chuck, is the closet door clicked shut? We don't want it pushing out and getting us tonight. Just reinforce that for a couple weeks. Then the fun begins. And get about 2 o'clock in the morning, take the doll out of the closet, stick it underneath my brother's blankets, and just wait for morning. So yes, it required changing a few sheets, but it was worth it. So that's this side of my brain, a little more twisted, a little weirder. I kept reading when I was growing up. I was like throwing gasoline on this side of the brain. But, you know, I knew if I did this, this, and this, I could become a veterinarian. And though I had this desire maybe to someday walk into a bookstore and see my book on a shelf, there was no clear path to becoming an author. You could do this and this and still fail as an author. So this sounded more logical, so I became a veterinarian, continued to read. That desire just got bigger and bigger as I got older. Eventually, I thought, you know, if I'm going to ever try writing, I better start writing. I better try it. If I'm ever going to succeed, I have to put words on paper. So I began writing a bunch of short fiction, nothing ever sold. 4 years I wrote short fiction. I think I wrote about 24 short stories, and I was adamant about sending them out to different marketplaces, and rejection after rejection after rejection, until finally I got one acceptance, which is the biggest thrill in my life. Because you usually get these, you know, these rejection letters. It's disappointing, and so you finally get this rejection letter from it's a small press magazine. I don't want to, you know, blow my horns. Anybody subscribe, by the way? Maybe you do because this is Denver, to a magazine called The Wretched Truth. The Wretched Truth. No. It's a small press magazine. It's a vegetarian, vegan magazine, animal rights magazine. I had written this story called A Christmas Tale, T-A-I-L. How clever. It's a cautionary tale on why you should not buy a puppy for somebody for Christmas. It's a tear-jerking, horrible ending. Don't read it unless you want to cry. You know the old adage, you know, you should never kill an animal in a book or a story. Well, you know, I've got a veterinary license, so I have a license to kill. So it ends horribly. But again, that's, I think, why that appealed to this vegetarian animal rights vegan magazine. But, you know, and they weren't going to pay me. It was a barter deal. For my story, they were just going to give me free copies of the story. By the way, is there any lawyers in the audience? Thank you. So it's a barter. A barter is considered a sale, is it not? I just want verifiable proof, because then I told everybody I sold my story. I was a published author who made a sale. And I told my friends, I told my family, I told my critique group that I belonged to, I told the bagger at the grocery store, and he's like, cool, paper or plastic? I was going to frame this magazine when it came in, the start of my career. Eventually does arrive. I open up the package, so excited. Basically, the magazine is mimeographed sheets of paper folded in half, punch holed, and tied with yarn. It's in a frame in my office. Every query letter I sent out to publishers, proudly published in The Wretched Truth. Because I figured nobody in New York probably subscribes to a magazine that is tied with yarn. So it was a safe bet they weren't going to check that out. So based upon that huge success, I thought, I'm going to write a novel. Why not? I'm a published author. So I tackled my first novel. It took me a while, 11 months, writing 3 double-spaced pages a day. Boom, boom, boom. Took me a while. Finally got it finished and began collecting more rejection letters. It was 49 different agents rejected that novel. It was the 50th agent that eventually picked it up. And the rejections were not necessarily kind rejections. Usually they become so impersonal. They're just form letters. You know, dear sir, ma'am, we hate your novel. Don't submit to us again, editor. But occasionally some editor might give you a pat on the back, a little acknowledgement. They'll write your personal note on the back of that letter. You know, I like that. This one character, Jim, the rest of them really suck. But trust me, as an author, you can survive a long time on I like that one character. That little pat on the back, it takes a sting out of the rejection. So I'll give you one example. I got this rejection from a St. Martin's Press editor. He was kind enough to send me the form rejection letter, but I do see that he has written something on the back. I thought, well, okay, good. I'm going to get my pat on the back. It's just 3 words. This is unpublishable. Well, that was nice of him to reject me, but take the extra special time to kick me in the nuts besides. So I appreciated that. But again, I did it. That 50th agent did see something in it. She ended up selling it. That was Subterranean. So it did well on the bookshelves. And NBC picked up it for film rights. Never did anything with it, but it was pretty cool. And I still see that editor occasionally at book conferences. He's still in the business. He now runs whenever he sees me because I've been needling him constantly for the past decade and a half. Because revenge is sweet. That's basically how a veterinarian became an author. I mean, my clients began to become suspicious, mostly because, you know, posters in my lobby, you know, get your cat spayed, get a free book. So questions began to arise. Dr. Jim, you have this successful veterinary hospital. What's this writing business? What's your long-term goal? What's your hopes and dreams? And I'm thinking, how nosy you people are. But I tried to answer it as best I could. I said, well, you know, for 15 years, veterinary medicine was my paycheck, and writing I wasn't making a cent off of, except for my free copies of The Wretched Truth. I thought, wouldn't it be really cool to eventually see that turn around and have, you know, my writing be my paycheck and veterinary medicine just be my hobby? I somewhat achieved that goal at this point. I write full-time, but I still do some volunteer work. Work with a group that traps feral cats, wild cats. They bring them to the local shelter. I spend 8 hours spaying and neutering them one Sunday a month. It's basically all I now do with my veterinary medicine is just remove genitalia. But it is a hobby. So that's basically how I came to be standing in front of you. It's a weird process, I know. So I'm going to jump in and talk a little bit about the book and then open up for Q&A. I'm always challenged by talking about the books. I don't want to give anything, you know, too much away. So I always like to just pick up a few tidbits to tantalize you to hopefully find a cash register somewhere in this building. So The Sixth Extinction is the 10th book in the series. And writing this, I knew this was the 10th book in the series. So there's a certain amount of this weight hanging above my head. And I'm writing the 10th Sigma novel. It's got to be spectacular. It's got to be bigger. How am I going to try to make this bigger? So I did one thing. I thought, well, one thing I want to do is I want to, being that this is sort of a pivotal book, I want to acknowledge some things that occurred in the past. So certain elements of the story echo back to maybe that very first book I was telling you about. We're visiting Antarctica a little bit in here. And so you might see somebody that you might have seen in the past. And there's weird things going on in the jungle involving weird, twisted creatures that might echo of something else you've seen. But there's also Easter eggs in here, little hints of where the story's heading in the future, where the Sigma story's going. So I want to sort of have that book be sort of this pivot between the past and the present. But also I wanted, the scope had to be bigger. You know, this is the 10th novel. I couldn't just settle for something simple. It had to be bigger. You probably know I blow things up in my books. I had earlier on in this tour, my very first stop was in Phoenix, and this woman raises her hand and says, I'm an archaeologist, and I want to know what your problem is with archaeology. What do you mean? You keep blowing up historical sites. I do, because I like to. So I thought, well, this one, I'm not just going to blow up a historical site. I'm going to just point a big gun right at the entire planet and see what happens. So again, bigger scope. So the Sixth Extinction is the title, so you can guess basically what the topic is. Right now, the consensus among scientists that we are at the brink of a new mass extinction event. There's been 5 events in the past. This is the 6th one that we're heading into. We lose 3 species every hour, 30,000 species a year. Scientific America just 2 weeks ago, had an article saying that we have maybe 1 or 2 generations to stop this stem of this extinction, or we're going over the ecological cliff. So I thought, as you know, I'm building a story around maybe this pending extinction event, we better figure out how we're going to stop it. Because the first 5 extinction events were natural causes. They were volcanic eruptions that spewed CO2 in the air and caused these major global changes. Asteroid strike knocked out the dinosaurs. Well, in this case, we are the asteroid this time around, and that it's our trampling of this planet that is triggering this extinction, from pollution to the globalization of invasive species to urbanization. And so since we caused this mess, we should probably get out of this mess, and I assume somebody is doing something to stop it. So that's where my research began. So I began looking into what is really going on in the scientific fields to try to stem this. And I found things that were just, cool stuff, and some things that were more on the creepy side. So guess where we play? So on one side is the conservationists, the preservationists. These are the ones that are trying to preserve old species, including to the point of even resurrecting extinct species. On this side is the synthetic biologist trying to engineer our way out of this extinction by creating new species, splicing in genes, playing with that whole genetic toolbox. The more I looked in here, weirder things got. Got a little creeped out by some of the things I was reading, and I'll just give you some examples. After 9/11, there was an uptick in biodefense spending, so there's all of a sudden a proliferation of BSL-4 labs, Biosafety-4 labs. These are the labs that deal with the worst of the worst, Ebola, Marburg, Lassa fever. There's 15,000 scientists credentialed right now to work in these BSL-4 labs right now. And it's not just these labs. It's breaking out of these sort of controlled labs. Right now, most of these BSL-4 labs are government-backed, university-funded, corporate-sponsored. Well, now we're seeing it sort of breaking out of these sort of formalized labs and appearing in attics and in garages and in community centers, because the whole movement called the biopunk movement, similar to the cyberpunk movement in the past of the 90s. Cyberpunks, so they were hacking into computer code. Biopunks are hacking into genetic code. The cost of doing genetic code has gotten so cheap that they can actually afford to do it in a garage. And so the people right now are actually producing new life forms and patenting these new life forms. So I'm thinking, well, okay, is anybody watching this happen? Is anybody looking over these people's shoulders? So, and this is the creepiest part of my entire research. The Directorate of the Biological Countermeasures Unit of the FBI took my call. Something's wrong with that right there. And so I posited him, you know, okay, I'm doing this book on this, you know, possibly, you know, what's going, something might go awry in one of these labs. I'm just building up the story, but I figured I better know what the countermeasures are, since you are the directorate of the Biological Countermeasures Unit. Surely you will inform me and give me great detail about how we're managing this. And he says, oh, yes, I'll be happy to give you that information. Great. So I've learned that there's 15,000 scientists credentialed to operate in BSL-4 labs. So how many agents do you have that are watching over that? I'm sure you don't have 15,000. He goes, no, not at all. We can't afford that. Budgets are tight. You know, finances are pretty stiff. Well, how many do you have? Zero. Well, that's a little bit less than I was expecting. So what about these labs that are like occurring in like garages and attics and producing these weird life forms, and you know, isn't that like a recipe for disaster? He says it is indeed. It's not a matter of if something's going to happen that's going to go wrong, it's when. Well, then what are you doing over here in these labs? Oh, well, don't worry. We depend upon self-policing. We figure if something goes wrong, they'll tell us. You're not reassuring me. And you shouldn't be, because we're worried basically about three things. The FBI is, and Homeland Security for that measure. We're worried about bioterrorism. We're worried about somebody putting a student in one of these postdoctoral programs who's going to either steal something or learn a technique that they're going to take home and end up being a disaster down the line. Bioterrorism. Two, worry about lab accidents. And USA Today, just last week, had an article that there was 1,100 lab accidents in these labs. And you've probably also heard about the smallpox vials that were discovered in a closet at the National Institute of Health, right next to a ventriloquist doll. Lab accidents. Three, the purposeful release of organisms. And again, I use this example in the book. I'll share it with you right now. There's a Kickstarter program out there. A group of biopunks have managed to splice a glowing gene into a common weed. And for $40, they'll send you 100 of those seeds. And right now, they have 5,000 backers. So if you do 5,000 times 100, so basically they're prepared to dispense 500,000 of these seeds. And what they want you to do with them? Spread them far and wide, which could make for some pretty fields glowing in the dark. But of course, nature being nature, things escape, things twist, things mutate. And we're not quite sure what the environmental impact will be from that. So those are the three things: bioterrorism, lab accidents, the purposeful release of organisms. So I'm thinking, okay, I need to handle, you know, I need something to hinge my story on. I'm a thriller writer. And now you give me three things to write about. Now, which one do I want to choose? Well, it's a 10th book. I'm doing all three. So that's what you're going to be seeing in this book, is this big adventure surround dealing with this whole new extinction event that we're tipping over the edge of, and what's going on in the different sciences to protect that. Also some history of Antarctica, history going back to the voyage of the Beagle and Charles Darwin. So that's what's awaiting you in this book. And again, I don't want to tell you too much more because, again, as I mentioned before, there's a cash register somewhere in this building. So I'm going to end my formal talk about the book and open it up for Q&A to find out, again, like, why are you here? I know why I'm here. Why are you? Way at the back. Thank you for raising your hand so quickly.
This is the second book that has dealt with Antarctica
pretty involved.
Have you ever actually visited?
I have. You know, back if you asked me a couple years ago, no. But I can't say I've really been to Antarctica. I did a cruise and I like touched it. 7 continents. Done. So I can't say like I bet to McMurdo when did an intense study of Antarctic life, but I did touch it. Yes. How do you pick names for the different characters in the book? I wish there was a clear way of doing that. Sometimes it's just pops in my head because it's a reflection of the character. I came up with the name Painter Crow. And I like that name, and only then did I realize he's Native American. So it's because the name sounded Native American, so I became Native American, or half Native American. Sometimes it's people I know. People are like, put me in the book, Jim, put me in the book. Well, I'll put you in the book, but I get to kill you in a horrible, horrible way. So if somebody dies horribly in my book, probably a friend of mine. Did everybody read Ice Hunt? Remember how a certain villain dies in that book? Friend of mine. So there's no clear process. Sometimes it's sometimes I labor for a while. Sometimes the name changes many times during the course of the book. Like right now, I just changed the name of a character that I'm doing a polish on. It's like, I still don't like this name, so I changed it. Yes, go over here.
One of these, you were asked to
The question is if Kowalski is still my favorite character. And yes, I mean, I recruited, you know, Kowalski from Ice Hunt because he doesn't really belong in Sigma, let's be honest. But I loved him, so I thought, I don't care, he's coming. I'm dragging him into Sigma. Some people ask me, you know, how come we haven't learned more about Kowalski? Because we never really get much history of Kowalski. You know, it's never been a light shined on Kowalski. You know, we shine lights on the different books, shine on different characters, depending upon the book. I've never written a scene in a Sigma novel from Kowalski's point of view. The only time I've written from Kowalski's point of view is a short story called Kowalski's in Love. Other than that, never been his point of view. Well, the book I'm, you know, the next Sigma after this, guess what? You're going to find more about Kowalski's scenes written from his point of view. You're going to find more of his background and learn how he ticks. Only appropriate because that book, next book, deals with Neanderthals. It's only appropriate. Time to look at Kowalski. At the back.
What about animals in your books? Are they ever modeled after animals?
Are the animals in my books ever modeled after animals in my life? My dogs, I love them dearly. They're not that smart. You know, Kane has a vocabulary of like 1,000 words. My dog probably, I'm lucky if he got 4, you know. And I apparently don't know down. But yeah, you know, again, I love animals. I love just populating them. This book features a dog, a Siberian Husky named Nico, owned by a park ranger named Jenna. Where they came from is that I ran a contest last year saying, send me pictures of you reading Eye of God in a creative and fanciful manner, and I'm going to pick the best one, and if I pick you, you're going to be in the book. And so a young woman from San Diego sent me a picture of her sort of lying on the floor reading the book. Her Siberian Husky's right here with a little pair, wearing a pair of eyeglasses. Pretty cute in and of itself, but what really attracted me to the picture is that Nico is sort of looking over the cover of the book at the camera, and his expression is like, this book is a piece of crap. Everybody's a critic. So Jenna, it was actually Jenna Beck, who was the winner of that contest, the park ranger that's featured in this book, and I couldn't, of course, if I'm bringing Jenna, I couldn't leave Nico, because even Jenna didn't know Nico was coming on board until she actually read the opening chapter, so I wanted to surprise her that her dog was in the book too. Over here. Why not? The question is, why DARPA? It came about because, again, I was never planning on doing a series. When I wrote Sandstorm, the main character really is a British archaeologist, but Painter Crow appears in that. I needed sort of a militarized American that was going to help her out, and I wanted somebody that had a sort of scientific background, and I thought, well, you know, but I have a lot of contacts in DARPA, so I know so that they're always at the cutting edge, the fringe of what's going on technologically in the military, and I thought, you know, if somebody's going to be dealing with this type of threat, that's a cool place to play in. And then I thought, well, they need guns, so they need to have a military background, so that's where Sigma began to form. So it basically came about because when I wrote Amazonia, this is a little bit long answer, but not that long. So I wrote Amazonia. For those that haven't read Amazonia, it deals with a bit of science that's true, that there's one scientist that developed a strain of mice where she knocked out the immune system of these mice and discovered just by pure chance the odd feature of these mice that, like, when you cut off their tail would grow back. So by knocking out the immune system, they found out that it seemed to return the ability to regrow gross bodily limbs. Little esoteric piece of science. Most people didn't know about it. I thought it was really cool. End of my idea box. When sort of writing Amazonia, that became the sort of crux of that story. That story begins with this gentleman going into the jungle with missing one arm. He comes back out. He's dead, but he's got both arms. What happened to him? So about a year and a half after writing that book, I get a call at home. And it's the husband of the woman who did that research. He's out of the blue, had happened to pick up a copy of Amazonia and was reading it and realizes, you know, I mentioned his wife's name, talked about her research. And so he was thrilled to hunt me down. Just want to thank me for putting her information in the book. And at that point, I was working on Sandstorm. It was about a year and a half later. So just working on the Sandstorm. She goes, oh, and by the way, now she works for DARPA.
So that's, again, I had a sort of inside wing into DARPA. So that got me the seed of thinking about DARPA. Pure chance. Are you raising your hand? You're pointing at somebody. Yeah, thank you. No. Thank you for asking that, though, because it's that, you know, I have, you know, I always, they always pitch me as this adventure writer. I scuba dive a cave. Well, I haven't had a cave like 4 years. And so, and most of the reason why I was, you know, getting close to my 50th birthday and my waistline was getting a little bit wider, my knees were getting a little tired, and I thought, well, caving's a young man's sport. I shouldn't be caving anymore. Diving where you can float, where, you know, the extra fat is good buoyancy. It's an advantage. So, but I still belong to the caving club. So I go to the caving meetings, the National Speleological Association, the grotto that I belong to in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'd go, if there's a lecturer that was doing something I wanted to hear, I'd go there and listen to the lecture. After the lecture, members can come up there and do a slideshow or some type of presentation of a trip maybe they went on. So this gentleman came up and was doing a slideshow of a fairly technical cave. It was difficult. It was challenging. It was very cool. I was envious that he was able to do this. And he was 65 years old. So I'm realizing, okay, maybe it's not, maybe I'm just fooling myself. There's no reason I can't still cave. And prior to that, there was, they post different caving trips that are coming up. And there's one caving trip I really wanted to go to. It's a caving trip in Southeast Asia. I thought that would be really cool to do that. And mixing sightseeing and caving. I would love to do that. But again, at that point, I'm thinking, can't, too fat, too old. So once I saw this guy, I thought, okay, well, if he could do it at 65, there's no reason I can't try to get in better shape and get myself in the ability where I can go on that trip. So that was my carrot. So that's why I might be a little thinner than last time I was here. So I had lost like 60 pounds since December in preparation for returning to my caving. And who knows, there might be another story in that. Yes, sir.
Did you recently have a birthday?
Yes, I did. Thank you for asking. Yeah, so that was it was very nice. I was in Birmingham, Alabama for my birthday, and the bookstore there kindly, I don't know how they found out about it, and they got a birthday cake for me, so it was very cool. Nice way to celebrate it. Thank you.
So what's coming up next for you?
War Hawk is the next book in the Tucker Kane series, so that's going to come out in April. Rebecca and I have already finished Blood Infernal, that's what we're still calling it. They have not corrected it, so I'm assuming it's staying that title. And we don't have an exact pub date, but I'm guessing January, February. It was December last time, but I don't think we're going to do December. We only do December because that book was centered around Christmas, so we released it around Christmas. This is not. This is centered more around Easter, so I'm thinking that will probably be more January, February. Yes, sir. Any more story? Any idea about doing more about the Dead Sea Scrolls? Yeah, that's how I've got a whole thing like Emerald Tablet and all these. One day I can't figure out what to do yet. I'll find out one of these days. Yes. What's my favorite book in the Sigma series? Lee Child told me how to answer that. He said, it's whatever the most expensive book is. So by that, I should say, this is the best book in the Sigma. Now, I say that facetiously, but actually I do think this is one of the best. I'm very proud of this book because it has elements of everything I write, the weirds, the evolution of biology, there's everything, you know, the caving. So it's a little bit of everything that I love. So I like it personally. You might not like it, but I like it. Yes. So you're asking if I outline or am I an organic writer? That's always, we get that question a lot because there's two different schools. One is the outliners that will put every little plot detail down on paper before they write. Jeffrey Deaver is notorious for that. He's notorious for writing 200-page outlines, and then he throws in dialogue and he's done. And other people don't like that. I like to just sit there with a blank page and let's see what story comes to light. I'm somewhat in the camp in between a little bit because I need to know. I know the beginning. I know the end. Oftentimes, I know the last line before I write the first line. And I'll do at least three or four stopping points in between, the big major tent poles that are going to support that story. But I don't necessarily know A connects to B connects to C. To me, one of the joys of writing is that discovery between those points. So if I know the story in too great detail, it deadens it a little bit. Now, when I do the collaborative work, we have to outline it in great detail because we're going to assign different parts to different writers. So if I'm writing this part and Rebecca's writing this part and she goes this way and I'm going this way, it makes it confusing. It also helps, you know, just to get an idea where we're heading. It's not, to be honest with you, I prefer writing organically. I prefer that unknown between there. It's a little terrifying sometimes, like, I don't know what I'm going to write next. Or I've painted my characters into a corner and I have no idea how to get them out of it. But I like when I do that because if I can't figure out how to get them out of a jam, none of you are going to either. So then I've got to come up with a clever way of getting them out of there, but I have time to think about it. You're going to go, you just turn the page. You go, oh, that's clever. But that, like, sometimes it takes 3 days to figure that out. No. Go back there. Okay, back where we left off. Yes. I don't know why.
Uh-huh.
Ugh. You're asking the question. Usually, I forgot to do this. I usually do this every time before I start the Q&A. Guess what question all authors hate to hear? It's always, where do you get your ideas from? We don't know. And we're afraid the process will dry up a little bit. Because it's weird. There's not a set way I plot or build a story. You know, I've mentioned before, I've always got my antenna up. I collect a bunch of ideas. I'm looking for basically three things. I'm looking for a historical mystery, a piece of history that ends in a question mark, something I can try to solve within the pages of a novel. I'm looking for that bit of science that makes me go, what if, or where are we heading, and where that might be going. And I'm looking at cool locations, places to set the story that I'm really fascinated by, especially if there's some interesting histories tied to that. Ends up in a big jumbled box. It's just one box. And I have to keep it to one box, otherwise it'll become two boxes, and two boxes go to four boxes. And, you know, James Rollins on Hoarders. we don't want that. One box. So to keep it to one box means I've got to sift through it and get rid of ideas that either somebody else has already tackled or ideas that no longer interest me. But what will happen is, you know, that piece of science, that piece of history will end up in my hand at the same time. And I'll begin to see connections between them. And then the story will build. I'll follow that and it'll dry up. Other times it gets bigger and bigger. And so that's the story I know I want to tell. But the direction comes many different ways. I wrote Amazonia because it came from the location. I wanted to set a story in the Amazon. So that's where the seed for that story began. Devil Colony started from history. You know, I wanted to deal with the fact that the Indians were sort of whitewashed out of the American history books and how influential they were to the founding documents. This and some of the other books start with a science. So each place sort of ends up differently. Characters. When I started with character, I wanted to write the first veterinary thriller, and that became Altar of Eden with Dr. Laura Polk, a New Orleans veterinarian. So it happens in different directions. And I wish there was a set path that I could do this, this, and this every time. Yes?
After you go down those different directions, do you ever wish that you had done something different in the previous book?
Always. I mean, I think no author doesn't go, oh, I wish I could go back and change that, or I wish I'd, you know, especially this book. This book was hard because things kept changing so rapidly in this industry. I actually had to stop the presses and say, okay, this information that just came out in the news, I need to get this in the story because I thought I was making it up. And I don't think anybody's going to believe it. And now it's true. So I need to make sure that that's known. So I actually had to actually fold that in on the fly. And the fact, like, just like the 1,100 lab accidents were just announced last week. Today was the announcement of the discovery of Antarctic life buried, you know, miles under the ice in a lost system that's been buried for millennia. It was like, somebody, you know, James heard about this. Okay, we can finally release that information. Sorry to be made public. Rollins ruined it. Yes.
Who do you read in your spare time?
Who do I read? I read a lot of different, jump across different genres. I mean, I generally used to read every Clive Cussler that comes out. I read Steve Barry, I read Brad Thor, because we sort of grew up the ranks together. And if I don't, they would yell at me. They keep trying to stump me because occasionally they'll put like some reference, and if I don't get it, you know, there'll be some nod towards one of my books, and if I don't recognize that, they go, "You didn't read the book." I did so. But I also read different genres. You know, I've been reading George R. R. Martin from back when I was in high school. So I've been following, you know, I read Game of Thrones back when it first came out ages ago. And I remember still when it got to the point where it was introduced to the dire wolves and the fact that, the you know, Snow was, you know, off by himself. I got so frustrated, I threw the book across the room and broke the spine. So I broke the spine of my first edition of hardback copy of Game of Thrones. It's like, I can't write this well. Mysteries in Nevada Bar. She writes her mystery set within the national park systems. Different national parks is featured, and each national park is almost like a character in itself in each of those novels. So that's just fun to read for me. So I could go each genre. I have certain ones that are just like my go-to people. Of course, Michael Crichton. You know, unfortunately, he passed away, but you know, he was still, as you couldn't guess, close to my heart. Oh, the pressure's on. Well, thank you for asking that, because that's the answer is the same. The question is, am I ever going back to the Clemens books or the Jake Ransom books? Let's start with Jake Ransom. Jake Ransom, I got a little note from the publisher saying, "Hey, Jim, middle school, they want books every 6 months." "Oh, are you nuts? My head will explode. I'm barely making it every year. I can't do it every 6 months." Then let's rejigger this series. Just write all 5 books, and then we'll relaunch them when you're done, and we're going to go ahead and release them every 6 months. So Jake Ransom and the Cauldron of Doom, already done. Haven't started the fourth one, but just got the already have the idea for the fourth one. Godslayer Book 3, already finished. 125 pages in Godslayer Part 4. So when that book, fifth book, is done, Penguin's going to get into the same thing. Re-release the whole books, release them every 6 months. So a bit of gap, and I think it's going to come really fast. So thank you for asking. Yes.
If you're working on so many different books at one time and you have short stories and all these, how do you keep your characters straight? Do you work on, you know, one thing at a time for 3 weeks and then switch off?
Normally, the question is how do I juggle many different things? Initially, I used to always just write one book, and then once that's done, I'd write another book, and then I'd write another book. But with the collaborative process, I've got to work at simultaneously. And that's a little tricky sometimes, but not so much the characters, because as I mentioned before, these stories are outlined to a T. We know every little nook and cranny of that story, how every little tick is going to occur in that story. So since that's so roadmapped, it's easy just to keep that in its. And also, I'm just writing pieces of it so that, you know, I just have to know what I have to know for that scene. And I sort of know what's leading into it and where it's going out of and what I have to, where I've got to start and where I've got to end. So it's pretty structured. Whereas this more amorphous thing that I create over here it works almost a different muscle of the writer's toolbox. So it's not as difficult as I thought it was going to be. It was a little challenge. Like, I don't know if I could do this, but it actually wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate it very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.